You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of April, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, our Hong Kong bureau chief, Aisha Spears, joins us to set the day's news agenda with the three stories we need to know. What do you have for us today, Aisha?
We've got a lot of boats. The US Navy are in Singapore, and there's been a boat collision in the Hong Kong harbour. And then we're also going to update you on the possible flu virus here.
Back here on dry land, as parliamentarians vote on whether to pass the Cypriot bailout deal agreed by the Troika of International Lenders, could we be back to square one?
The opposition parties that make up 25 MPs in the 56-seat parliament have been extremely vocal against the bailout deal, but it remains to be seen if, when the crunch vote does actually take place, they will also reject it.
We'll head to Denmark to find out why the nation's teachers are locked out of their classrooms for a third straight week.
And in today's preview of the menu, we're off to Seoul to wake up and smell the coffee.
It's kind of become more like a hobby for many people, I would say, rather than just you're not just paying for your coffee. It's become part of the whole coffee culture where you're paying to be seen at a cafe and you're paying for this kind of luxury of drinking this expensive cup of coffee, I guess.
All that plus, we'll take a ruffle through this morning's Canadian papers and we play some great music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
It's coming up to 8:02 a.m. here in London. That means it's time for the headlines. Here's David Spencer.
Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. Photographs of two suspects in the Boston Marathon bombing have been released by the FBI. The two men, known only as Suspect 1 and Suspect 2, are seen carrying backpacks and wearing baseball caps. They're seen minutes before bombs exploded near the finish line of the race. One is seen placing his backpack on the ground moments before three people were killed and 176 injured in the attacks. Richard Deslorius, the FBI special agent in charge of the investigation, has made a passionate plea for public help.
Somebody out there knows these individuals as friends, neighbors, co-workers, or family members of the suspects. Though it may be difficult, the nation is counting on those with information to come forward and provide it to us.
Hours after the pictures were released, a gunman shot dead a police officer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology near Boston. Officials say he was responding to a report of a disturbance. A major police operation has taken place in Watertown, near to the campus, amid reports of explosions and gunfire there. It's unclear if the two incidents are related or if they're connected to the marathon bombing. Former Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf has appeared in court. He was detained by police a day after a judge issued an arrest order for the former army chief over allegations he committed treason while in office. Television footage showed Musharraf being escorted to court by police. Rescuers are still searching for survivors of a huge explosion at a fertilizer plant in Texas, in which 14 people are now known to have died. The blast injured more than 160 people when it rocked the town of West, 80 miles south of Dallas. The cause is still not known. Texas Governor Rick Perry says the community will find it hard to recover.
West is a really small community, and just a few thousand people. Anyone who grew up In a small town like West, they know that this tragedy has most likely hit every family. It's touched practically everyone in that town.
Thousands of people have marched on downtown Buenos Aires to protest against proposed reforms of Argentina's judicial system. The government says it wants to democratize the nation's courts. President Cristina Fernandez's reforms include public elections to pick members of the Magistrates' Council, a powerful body that nominates and disciplines the nation's judges. Opponents claim that would give her more power to select people sympathetic to her views. Pink Floyd guitarist David Gilmour has paid tribute to Storm Thorgerson, the man who designed many of their famous album covers, after his death, aged 69. A childhood friend of the band, Thorgerson created the iconic artwork for Dark Side of the Moon, a prism spreading a spectrum of colour on a black background. Gilmore said the artworks Thorgerson created were an inseparable part of their work. He most recently designed album covers for rock bands Muse and Biffy Clyro. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. David will be back in about 25 minutes with another check of the latest world news. It is 8:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. But it is now to Hong Kong, where we're going to head to next. It's the part of the show with our daily agenda setter, the three stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. An agenda set today by our Hong Kong Bureau Chief, Aisha Spears. Good afternoon to you, Aisha. What's got your attention there today in Hong Kong and the region?
Well, the morning news was very much focused on what's going on actually in Singapore. The USS Freedom, the first literal combat ship from the US Navy, arrived in Singapore yesterday at the start of an eight-month deployment in Southeast Asia. Literal means that it can operate close to shore, so it works well in shallow waters. It arrived at Changi Naval Base, also with a really large naval helicopter, and it will be responsible for covering about 35 countries, including North and South Korea and, of course, China. It's part of an agreement between the US and Singapore, which was announced 2 years ago, that up to four of these ships can be deployed to Singapore. And it's part of this US focus shifting the pivot, the China pivot, to this part of the world as opposed to the Middle East. As they bring their assets out of the Middle East, they'll be putting about 60% of the US Navy's assets into Asia Pacific. This has caused a little bit of concern with China, as you can imagine. They've said that this isn't really a responsible thing to do. The US say it's just about maintaining open trading lanes, but I assume this is going to be something we'll be seeing a lot of over the next few years.
And how have people where you are reacted to that news? Is this something that's a comfort, that this sort of firepower is coming in, or is it a concern as to what might be done with it in future?
I think most of the region does see it as somewhat of a comfort. You know, it's capable of going into parts of Malaysia, which is having problems with the Philippines, other areas of conflict, and that might be a good thing. The only people who clearly aren't going to be happy with increased US military presence here are China and North Korea, but that's no surprise.
And I just wanted to touch on that, Aisha. Obviously, the crisis on the Korean Peninsula has subsided slightly. There hasn't been any ridiculous, rhetoric that's been spewing out of the North recently in the past few days. Do we have a sense of the reaction then from China or North Korea over this deployment?
Well, as we know, China's been a little bit kind of hesitant to really go forth and support what North Korea is saying. In Hong Kong, there's been a little bit of laughter. I think the same similar reaction as what we would see across Europe and the US. It's obviously a concern, but not a huge pressing point of news each day, no.
Should we talk about Golden Week then?
We should talk about Golden Week, which I didn't know about until I read the papers today. Apparently this happens twice a year and it's a national holiday. Golden Week is when a lot of mainland tourists will take a holiday and a lot of them will come to Hong Kong. Last year, over 300,000 of these mainland tourists visited Hong Kong. Normally a good thing, a big boost for the Hong Kong economy. But obviously at the moment with the H7N9, it's really not catchy, is it? The flu virus, the threats that are going on in the mainland, Hong Kong is advising the hotels and the travel agencies to be pretty vigilant. So they're worried about cases spreading here. So far, no actual cases in Hong Kong. There were some suspected ones last night, but they turned out to be negative. And in the mainland, it's apparently about 87 cases which have been made official. So those coming in next week for this Golden Week will be checked at border checkpoints with thermometers to see if they're ill, and if anyone's in a hotel and ill, hotels have been told to put them into isolation.
And how are you, as well as other Hong Kong residents, reacting to the influx of Chinese, mainland Chinese tourists to Hong Kong? Is there a sense that some Hong Kong residents are actually leaving the island because they're concerned over this bird flu scare?
Well, I think there is a constant influx of mainland tourists. From what I can understand, it's interesting talking to people who have hotels here, what they've had to change in terms of their hotel culture with the increased amount of money and custom they're getting from mainlanders. My colleagues here in the Hong Kong office have asked me if I can tell the difference between a local Hong Konger and a mainlander. I can't yet, but perhaps that's something I need to learn. But you do see them often queuing up outside Louis Vuitton, Prada, Gucci, and that's what will happen next week. So I think a lot of locals will be kind of staying in and not China shop in Kowloon.
Sounds like you've got some mainland Chinese trying to break into your office behind you there, which is a bit...
I know, so there's a lot of construction workers everywhere in Hong Kong, so there is a big building going up.
Well, that explains it. Well, you sort of touched on it there, but I wonder, clearly it's of huge economic benefit to have this sort of influx, but what sectors particularly does this sort of influx of mainland Chinese get drawn towards? Where do they spend most of their money?
Well, in a temporary tourist base, it's definitely luxury shopping. You really see a lot of them going in there and just buying out stuff that they perhaps can't get on the mainland, or they think the prices here are better. On the long-term investment level, it's in real estate. A huge percentage of apartments here have been bought out by mainland Chinese. And so I think, you know, Hong Kong definitely depends on them for their economy, but it is something which has to be treated in a way that's different from how Hong Kong locals, I think, are treated in terms of as consumers, at least.
And Aisha, speaking of tourism, Asia has been declared the fastest growing region for air travel last year.
It has been. So the fastest growing and most competitive market for air travel. There was a 9% increase in the number of passengers year on year from 2011 to 2012, which compares to only a 5% increase for global air travel. And North America, sadly, only a 2% increase. So clearly it's an important region. 7 out of the 10 busiest air routes in the world go through Asia. And it's what the industry is saying, that it's not only about those important key routes that we all know about, it's also about the fact that there are airlines here who are developing secondary ones, and there's a huge amount of competition as opposed to the European model where there's a lot less. And so I think it's going to be something over the next decade or so we'll see even faster growth.
Well, we are seeing a sort of a reorganisation of the chess pieces of global aviation in the last few years, aren't we? And various places bidding to become the next regional hub. How is this in that context? How has this news gone down in Hong Kong?
Well, I think in Hong Kong, people understand, I mean, they would expect that. Obviously, Hong Kong International Airport is a brilliant airport. People love to come to Hong Kong almost because of it, but also it's a great place to transfer through. And you're seeing that, you know, that idea, people will happily fly, you know, sorry, we've got a little bit of banging again, fly through Hong Kong because of that. And I think it's a much more pleasant place to fly through here than it is the Middle East.
And very quickly, Aisha, there's been a horrific boat collision on the Hong Kong harbour earlier today.
There was. It was late last night, actually, on the south side of the island, just outside Stanley. 6 people are still missing after 2 boats collided. It came only a week after the 2 captains involved in the collision last October, where 39 people were killed, were both charged with manslaughter. It's surprising that there aren't that many fatal accidents in Hong Kong Harbour, seeing as how busy and hectic it is. But there was one. There were a few people did die last night, so I think a lot of people are quite shocked by that.
It's a story we'll keep watching here on Monocle 24 as well. Aisha Spears, our Hong Kong bureau chief, thanks for joining us here, bringing us up to speed with today's agenda setter. We'll leave you to the company of your construction men.
Coming up, a fresh vote from the Cypriot Parliament on the bailout deal provokes further uncertainty. We'll have the latest in a moment.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
It's just always going to be different, for me at least. I've never recorded an album in the same place under the same circumstances as the last record, so it's always going to be quite different.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week shows for an hour of essential listening.
The main market used to be Europe, of course, United States and Japan. Now you have tens of markets, very interesting, also regions. You have, of course, Russia, then you have Kazakhstan, you have so many other. It's a completely different world.
What could be greater than an hour of The Curator? Listen to it live or download it later.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets, and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists, and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews, and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
It's to Cyprus now, and given that the Cypriot administration nearly served up the savings of all their population to satisfy the hungry troika of international lenders, it was a relief for the Eurozone and for the Cypriot population when the bailout deal was met. Those with savings under 100 grand were spared, and perhaps preventing further economic woes for the once cosy tax haven.
Well, the terms of the bailout deal were reached upon, yet the vote to secure it in Germany's Bundestag was only passed yesterday, weeks later. Well, now the latest news is that the Cypriot parliament will themselves still vote to agree on the deal, with almost half the members of the 56-seat parliament apparently opposing the very bailout. Well, what better option there is? It's all unclear at the moment. Joining us on the line to flesh out the details and implications of yet more uncertainty is Athens-based journalist and regular Monocle contributor, Natalie Savarakis. Natalie, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. We had this passed in Germany's Bundestag yesterday, but there's no clear indication of whether this will pass the Cypriot parliament.
Absolutely. I mean, what we're hearing now is that the ruling coalition parties should essentially vote in favor. There are certain question marks, however, over two MPs that could swing the vote either ways. Now, we'll be hearing, I'm guessing, from them in the next week on what their stance will be, but for the moment, they're being a big headache for the president, Anastasiadis, who is counting on their support to actually push through this very controversial bill through parliament, essentially as the opposition parties have said that they will reject it. Now, the big question is, of course, whether the smaller opposition party will either reject or abstain from the vote. Remains to be seen what will happen.
Natalie, who are the key players here? Who are those people opposing it? And is it along party lines or is it individuals? And what particular elements of the bailout are they opposing?
Well, what we're not hearing yet whether they're opposing it or not. We still don't know whether they're going to vote in favour or reject it. They haven't been vocal about it, if you like. Now, of course, what's really preoccupying the Cypriot population here is how the Troika has dealt with the overall matter in a very colonial way. And that's what we've been hearing not only from the Cypriot people, but even from members of the European Parliament who were lambasting Commissioner Olli Rehn for the behaviour of the Commission on Cyprus, saying that they were very dismissive on the way they handled the Cypriot ministers and the Cypriot government. One Austrian MP even said that they had, as I mentioned earlier, a colonial attitude. And that's very much what the Cypriots here are fearing. Now, with the latest bailout agreement, they've seen one of their banks became bankrupt. The other one is set to 40% of the deposits are going to just vanish into thin air. So they're very, very fearful of what Europe's intentions are with this tiny island.
Well, I think it is fair to say, Natalie, that this entire process has been a complete disaster. Cypriots were furious when earlier this month there was going to be plans to put a tax or a levy on their savings. That's now been overturned. What's the sense there from the Cypriot people? Are they happy now that that original plan was put aside? And are they willing to open their arms to this new bailout deal? Or is there still a real sense of anger or disgust, really, against these kind of the Troika lenders?
I think most of the people that I was talking to the 3 weeks that I was there was essentially, at the beginning, they thought Europeans would help them. But as time progressed and as the second bailout came, which destroyed, if you like, the banking system of the country, which is one of the main pillars of the economy, as it draws and attracts a lot of investment from abroad. That's how the Cypriot economy, if you like, made it and became so strong, by attracting all those investors to the island because of its very stable banking system and attractive, very low corporate rates. They just thought the Europeans were out to destroy them for some reason. mainly they thought because of all these accusations that Cyprus was a tax haven, and yet they pointed at other jurisdictions in Europe that also had similar, if you like, attractive regulations and banking institutions which could serve as offshores or as tax havens. So they really didn't understand why Europe was behaving in this way. And of course, what they lamented was the fact that Europe didn't have, didn't think this through. What we're hearing now from the University of Nicosia is a prognosis for the future, which is very bleak. They're saying that unemployment is set to jump to 25% when it stands at 14 now. And of course, the other thing that they're adding to their prognosis is that the GDP is set to shrink by some 14%, which is huge, especially as this economy was, as I mentioned earlier, so heavily reliant on its banking system that has now all but collapsed.
That is a pretty bleak prognosis indeed. And you mentioned it's not clear who or why will oppose this. If the bailout is rejected by the Cypriots, what on earth happens then?
Well, that is a big question. I think the government spokesman, Stylianides, said it clearer. If you're going to reject it, at least give us some other solution. And we haven't been hearing of any other solutions. The big plan of the opposition party, the communists, IKEL, was to seek help from Russia. But of course, this didn't work out at all. Russia was very tight-lipped about any volunteering, any sort of help. So at the moment, we're not hearing of any alternative solution. Perhaps what the opposition is also lamenting is the fact that President Anastasiadis didn't negotiate the deal well enough and didn't safeguard, if you like, this pillar of the Cypriot economy, namely the banking system. Remains to be seen what will happen and how President Anastasiadis will convince IKEL or the smaller, as I mentioned, the opposition party to whether at least abstain as not to threaten this vote going through parliament.
And Natalie, just moving quickly from Cyprus to Athens, where you are, the Troika were in Athens earlier this week and they approved a new bailout deal. They also said that Greece should return to growth by 2014. Is there a sense there on the streets of Athens that finally things may finally be moving in the right direction?
Well, it depends who you're talking to. I mean, if you're talking to the ordinary people that have been really crushed by this slew of measures from the past years and have seen their salary shrink while taxation has gone up through the roof, they'll say they can't see any light at the end of the tunnel. Nonetheless, businesses are now starting to move and investment slight moves towards Greece have been made, if you like. But I've been speaking to accountants and economists who have said that the worst has yet to come, that the Greeks are still not realizing how difficult these measures are going to be. And the big shock will come towards the end of the year as the taxation levels are really insurmountable and very difficult to cope with. It remains to be seen if Prime Minister Samaras can actually draw the much-needed foreign investment to Greece. He needs to overcome many problems, namely bureaucracy, that is still one of the big, if you like, setbacks of this economy. Let's see till the end of the year. Time is running out. Opposition party is really trying to pressure the administration. Let's see, because many here, analysts, even predict elections by the end of the year.
So lots of uncertainty and unanswered questions there in both Cyprus and Greece. Natalie Savarakis, a regular Monocle contributor there in Athens. Many thanks for your time.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds, and with Phil Hahn too. The time is 9:24 a.m. in Copenhagen. That's where we're heading now for a roundup of the headlines.
Our correspondent, Michael Booth, is our man on the ground in Denmark, and he's on the line. Welcome, Mr. Booth, to the program. Let's get started with a story about a teacher's strike, but I thought it was really supposed to be all about the children. They're our future.
Yeah, aren't they just? But this is, we're all familiar with the notion of striking teachers, but this is a slightly reverse situation in that the government of Denmark has locked the teachers out of the schools. So 69,000 teachers are picketing streets and schools of Denmark right now. 900,000 kids are kicking their heels and having a good time. But a lot of parents are getting a bit frustrated now as this kind of lockout, as it's called, is entering its third week.
And what are the parts of the deal that are being fought over? What do the teachers need?
Well, the teachers aren't fighting. It's weird. The teachers aren't fighting for anything. What's happened is the government, a collective bargaining agreement that's been in place for many years with the teachers, came to an end last month. And the government wants them basically to work a few more hours. They have they used to have a restriction of only 25 hours of teaching during 1 week, but the government wants the head teachers to kind of take control of those teaching hours and decide how many hours the teachers actually work. And of course, the teachers aren't very happy with it. They haven't been able to come to an agreement. So the government has turned around and said, well, then don't come to work anymore until you can agree to our agreement.
Is there any sense of how long this lockout could potentially last?
Well, there are two deadlines coming up. The first is May the 1st, which the Danes take very seriously as International Workers' Day. Now, we currently have a so-called Red Bloc government in power. The Social Democrats with the Prime Minister Helle Thorning-Schmidt are supposedly left-wing. Now, imagine a scenario where you have a May the 1st Workers' Day, everyone partying on the streets to celebrate the rights of the workers, and with a left-wing government in power. Yet the government is at odds with one of the major unions in the country. That's going to be a bit awkward. And in fact, Helle Thorning-Schmidt, who normally gives a speech in the big park in Copenhagen here on May the 1st, won't be giving that speech. The mayor's going to be giving that speech, and I wonder if it's something to do with that slight awkwardness. The other issue is that the teachers' union only has enough cash to last for 2 months of this strike. They're continuing to pay their teachers, at least if the teachers come out and protest. They have to clock in protest and clock out to do their hours on the streets with the placards, but they only have enough money to last for 2 months, so that looks like the main deadline.
I guess one other sort of pressing issue that comes out of this, 900,000 kids who aren't going to school, how's that being handled?
Well, tell me about it. I have two of my own who I've been trying to entertain and keep occupied and force them to do a bit of homework. It's not easy. I mean, some of the schools are running some kind of skeleton service. Local bakeries have been holding baking clubs, and also, you know, people have been pitching in to try and help out, and a lot of grandparents have been called out of retirement to look after the kids.
And Michael, another story moving on to the right wing, the right wing anti-immigration party, the Danish People's Party. Apparently, some of their members have a bit of a problem with New Zealand.
Yeah, don't you just love it when right wingers really put their foot in it? And this has happened twice in the last week or so. The first time was a very prominent Dansk Folkeparti, a member of parliament called Marie Krarup, who blogged in a national newspaper her displeasure after a recent trip to New Zealand on official business, where she was welcomed with the traditional Maori, I think it's called a pauheri, you know, the kind of tongue-out, stomping dance that they do traditionally, the Maoris.
That sounds rather awkward indeed. I mean, right-wing anti-immigration parties, certainly in the UK, are very much on the fringe and have a level of respect that equates to their sort of political position. Is that the same with the Danish People's Party?
Oh. Michael, where did you go?
Poor old Michael. Obviously off entertaining his kids who aren't at school today on account of them and another 900,000 having no teachers. Michael Booth, I believe, may be back with us. Michael, have you returned?
I didn't go away, actually. I could hear you perfectly clearly. But as you were saying, the Danish People's Party have actually been very prominent and powerful and part of the government here in Denmark for many years, and they're not in that position at the moment, but they're, I think, the third party in the poll. So when one of their number comes back from New Zealand and starts talking about uncivilized Maoris who yelled and screamed at me and shocked that, in quotes, European-looking men spoke Maori and that she was affronted to have been forced to press noses with their traditional greeting, you know, that's a bit of a problem. And then another prominent Dansk Folkeparti, a rising young hope, talking about the rights of lesbian couples to be recognized as parents, said, what next, animals? And she'd previously made a similar comment about gay marriage. What's going to happen next? Are we going to be expected to marry dogs? So they sometimes they reveal their true colors, put it that way.
Slightly awkward, I think. Slightly awkward indeed. But Michael, very quickly, a new Danish film has just come out, and I hear it's getting some pretty rave reviews.
Yeah, I think we're going to be hearing about this internationally in the next few months. It's called Norvest. It's by documentary maker Michael Noah, who's turned to a kind of docudrama fiction style now. And it tells about the gang warfare between biker gangs in the suburbs of Copenhagen. Very violent, but very authentic, and it's been getting rave reviews in the Danish media.
Michael, thanks very much for updating us this morning from Copenhagen. Good luck looking after your kids, and glad we got you back. Michael Booth, thanks very much.
In the next half hour of the program, we head to Seoul to get a whiff of the coffee market, and we'll leaf through the Canadian front pages.
But first, it is at 8:30, right about time for your news headlines, and ready and waiting is David Spencer.
Thank you very much indeed. Just days after the twin bombings at the Boston Marathon, police are hunting the killer of a police officer at a university campus near the city. The shooting happened at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology hours after photographs of two suspects in Monday's bombing were released by the FBI. It's not known if the incidents are related. Former Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf has appeared in court after being arrested in Islamabad. He was detained by police a day after a judge issued an arrest order for the former army chief over allegations he committed treason while in office. Rescuers are still searching for survivors of a huge explosion at a fertilizer plant in Texas, in which 14 people are now known to have died. The blast injured more than 160 people when it rocked the town of West, 80 miles south of Dallas. Thousands of people have marched on downtown Buenos Aires to protest against proposed reforms of Argentina's judicial system. The proposals would see public elections to pick members of the body that nominates and disciplines the nation's judges. Opponents claim that would give President Cristina Fernandez more power to select people sympathetic to her views. Pink Floyd guitarist David Gilmour has paid tribute to their album designer Storm Thorgerson, who's died aged 69. Thorgerson created the iconic artwork for Dark Side of the Moon and most recently worked with rock bands Muse and Biffy Clyro. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. David, we'll be back at the top of the hour with another check of the world headlines. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
And this week on the menu, we'll meet top chef Michael Wignall. We'll find out what you do after your restaurant's already won the highest acclaim of world's best restaurant. That is a puzzler. And we'll also visit our brand new Monocle Cafe here in London to chat to the man supplying us with the top-notch beans we use to create great cups of coffee for everybody. You've already had one this morning.
I've got
you,
to admit, since that cafe opened, yeah, I feel like I'm constantly jacked up on caffeine.
Yeah, because yeah, it's so good.
It's like four cups a day.
Yes,
it's literally just 400 yards away, so it's extremely close.
It's kind of dangerous having that much coffee so close to a radio studio, isn't it?
It's dangerous, but also very good at the same time. And I've always wanted to go to a cafe where everyone knew my name.
Yes.
it's like cheers.
It's like, everyone says, Phil!
But instead of beer, it's coffee.
There you are, perched on the corner of the bar like Norm, downing yeah, your third pint of coffee. Yeah. Worrying.
Very worrying. Well, continuing along the coffee vein, we're going to be heading to Seoul for this preview. Now, it wasn't long ago that if you ordered coffee in South Korea, you'd end up with a Dixie cup filled with the powdered variety. But that's all changed now. South Koreans are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on coffee these days, and customs figures show consumption is growing around 10% a year.
Recently, Seoul hosted its second Coffee Expo, where coffee lovers came to talk about their favourite brews. Well, our correspondent Jason Strother was, of course, amongst them, and he filed this report from the expo.
For one reason or another, I didn't make my normal cup of espresso this morning, and I am absolutely jonesing for some coffee.
I will make café latte for you.
Ah, thank you.
Fortunately, Ro Jae-sung of the importing company HLI is here to help. He's demonstrating how to make a good cup of coffee using an Australian-made grinder and espresso machine.
Let's turn this baby on. Let's give it a try.
Yeah.
Ro confesses he's no barista, but like everyone else at the Coffee Expo, he can't do without his daily caffeine fix.
All right, my cafe latte. Wow, it looks delicious.
Yeah, thank you.
South Koreans are hooked on coffee. You can't throw a rock without hitting a cafe on the streets of Seoul, but it wasn't like this just several years ago.
Korea's coffee industry has absolutely boomed over the last decade or so, and it's gone from being virtually non-existent, and now Seoul actually boasts the highest concentration of coffee shops in any city in the world. There are over 10,000 in Seoul alone.
Rhiannon Shepherd works in marketing for COEX, the convention center that hosts the expo.
Coffee Expo Seoul was kind of born out of an idea that we would create a platform for the entire coffee business under one roof. So last year was the first year it ran, and we had about 80 exhibiting companies and 250 booths this year, over 450 booths and 150 exhibiting companies. So it's almost doubled in size in just 1 year. And we're also expecting over 50,000 visitors over the 4 days. At the Coffee Expo Seoul, you can just about find anything you would ever need if you are working in the coffee industry or you want to start a coffee business. We have everything here from the green beans to roasted beans. We have roasting machines, coffee machines, accessories for coffee cups and saucers, and also even furniture for cafes and things you need to start your own franchise. So everything coffee related is under one roof.
I was here in Korea back in 2002 and you couldn't get a good cup of coffee outside of Starbucks or whatever. How did Koreans become such coffee junkies in the past decade?
Originally, it was instant coffee and coffee mixers were what the coffee that existed here. That's what the coffee that people drank. And then I think it became more of kind of a fashion trend, I think.
Okay.
Because it's in Korea, you can often find yourself paying more for a cup of coffee than you can for a lunch. So you'll go out and you'll spend $4 on a lunch, and then you'll go and spend $5 or $6 on your coffee afterwards. And I think it's kind of become a little bit maybe like in some parts of America, kind of a fashion statement. Sit in a kind of fashionable cafe with your vanilla latte or iced Americano, whatever, with your friends. And it's kind of become more like a hobby for many people, I would say, rather than just you're not just paying for your coffee. It's become part of the whole coffee culture where you're paying to be seen at a cafe and you're paying for this kind of luxury of drinking this expensive cup of coffee, I guess.
Aside from all the free tastings and exhibitions, the expo holds classes for up-and-coming baristas. There's also a latte brew-off championship match.
My chef is 46 years old. I'm second generation.
Oh, wow. Okay.
David Cha has made a lot of lattes over the years. He runs the cafe Ethiopia Bed, which his in-laws opened in 1968. Cha says Koreans learned about real coffee after traveling overseas.
Many clever people studied in outside. They already tasted good coffee in America or in Europe, and they come back in Korea.
You seem like a clever guy yourself, so tell me, where did you learn to brew coffee? Did you...
Me?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm a surgeon. I was a surgeon, yes. I have studied in Italy, so I give up my career, and then I take this new job.
Wow, that's a big career shift.
Yes, very important this one. Yeah, I've just drink, and then my client or my patient asked, what is the coffee? How can make a coffee? Just like hobby. After it's come back in here, almost 20 hours per day, I'm studying, I'm trying, I'm roasting, and I'm copying. So I'm running from my father-in-law. How can make the copy.
Wow, okay, so you married the right woman.
Yes.
If you can tell me your secrets, what makes a good cup of coffee?
Good cup of coffee is first of things, so good green bean.
Okay.
And second is good hand picking and hand sorting. So you have to remove the defective bean. It's very important. It's a secret.
That's a secret.
Yes.
Removing defective beans.
Yes, sir.
How do you notice a defective bean?
Just sorting, hand picking.
Wow.
Everything is hand picking.
That must take a lot of time.
Yeah, a lot of time.
And Ethiopian beans, they're your preferred type of bean?
Yes.
What makes Ethiopian beans special to you? Why do you pick those?
This is the good balance. The sweet and acidity and sour and the bitter. And these things is a perfect balance. Okay, try this one.
Okay, sure.
And like any good host, Cha offers me a cup of Ethiopian coffee. Two women sitting around a small table and dressed in traditional garb pour it for me.
Do you want some sugar?
Cha suggests I add some sugar, which I normally don't use, but he was right. It's a really strong espresso, and evidently for good reason.
This is a warrior drinker. you take the coffee, it's more your reason.
Focus.
More better still. Yes, the wake up.
Yeah, sure.
So the warrior before the better some things, they have to take it this one.
Wow, okay, I'm ready to go to battle.
Yeah!
Let's do it.
Okay, I'm not really going to fight anyone. Why would I? I've had my fix, and the day has just begun. For Monocle and Soul, I'm Jason Struther.
Jason manfully managing not to sound too caffeinated at the end of that report, unlike the other people there. Wow.
I think before our show, we should have a warrior Ethiopian warrior coffee.
Let's do it.
And then we could be warriors going into battle.
Yeah, the show would be over in about 24 minutes. Done.
We'll crash.
Exactly. And you can catch more of those tasty caffeinated and some decaffeinated treats tonight at 1900 hours London time in the full episode of this week's menu, presented, of course, by Marquis Hippie, will air.
You're listening to Midori House.
The Globalist Asia is our brand new show covering global stories, but with a focus on what's shaping the business day from Beijing to Bangkok, Singapore to Sydney.
My vision of the Japan, how I see with this, I mean, I grew up in Paris, but that's how I see Japan.
There are also fresh insights from our global network of correspondents, contributors and editors, including a survey of the Asian front pages.
We're going to disagree to disagree, and we're just going to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and no one really has a playbook for how this turns out at all.
So tune in to The Globalist Asia every weekday for your global news digest. That's The Globalist Asia at 3 a.m. in Hong Kong, 4 a.m. in Tokyo, and 6 a.m. in Sydney. Brought to you in association with GE.
From the historic center of pencil making to the world's biggest trade fair, Monocle Films profiles a pioneering German stationery brand taking the pencil into the 21st century.
It is more or less in our genes to make pencils. And behind this is not only the region of Nuremberg, it's also the German type of engineering, of really digging deep into things, trying to understand things and to create novelties from this deep understanding of how things are made.
Sharpening Up with Stettler, in the film section on Monocle.com.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. The time here in London is 8:42, and it's 3:42 in the morning in beautiful New York City.
It certainly is. Now, it started as a film festival on a mission to redevelop Lower Manhattan after 9/11, and within just 12 years, it's become one of the most influential festivals in the US. This year, for example, they boast 53 world premieres from 37 countries. We're talking about Tribeca, of course, founded by Craig Hatkoff, Jane Rosenthal, and most famously by Robert De Niro. The festival generated $750 million in economic activity for the city.
Our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, spoke with Jenna Terranova, director of programming of the festival. She tells us what the festival means for her city.
I'd like to believe the festival means a lot to New York. It was started out of the wake of 9/11 as a way to get people downtown and rejuvenate the neighborhood. And, you know, 12 years later, Tribeca is a totally different place. And, you know, we generate tons of income for the community down here and just bring people back to life. I think that was the intention, and I think it still continues. There's such a strong sense of community about Tribeca. It's first and foremost about that. That's why Jane Rosenthal and Craig Hatkoff and Robert De Niro decided to start the festival. So that's an important part of festival and as a way to give back to New York. We have a lot of free events in addition to all the film screenings we do that really allow people to get out and meet each other and have a dialogue and have a conversation and enjoy the spring.
Great. And now let's talk about this year's festival. I know the festival opened already on the 17th. I want to ask, how was the opening? I saw that you did like a tribute to the victims of the bombing attack in Boston as well, right?
Yeah, I think we, you know, in Jane's remarks last night and some of the remarks, people are definitely saying, you know, our hearts and prayers go out to those families. We certainly, being from downtown, know the feeling of that tragedy and just feel that it's terrible and, you know, wanted to let people know that we're having a festival, but, you know, our hearts and prayers are with everyone. And the opening was great. I mean, we did a little bit of a different opening this year. We've done it before where we had a documentary and a musical element. So we had the band The National, which I'm sure many of your listeners know. They're a fantastic indie rock band based out of Brooklyn by way of Cincinnati. And this is a really fun story about two brothers. And one is the lead singer of The National. And the other is sort of the underdog slacker brother who is trying to be a filmmaker. And it's a story about them and making a film and making music. And it's really moving and funny and touching. And everyone had a great reaction to it last night. And we went and heard The National play in a really great venue. And they rocked it out. They did their typical National performance and was really crowd-rousing. So it was a great night.
I was going to ask, what are the main themes of this year's festival? Did you see, is there a theme for most of the films?
Yeah, there. I mean, we don't look for themes. The themes emerge generally after we program. I mean, when we had over 6,000 submissions this year, so the programming team looks at a lot of films, and as we're looking at them and making our selection, we generally are choosing between really great films and other really great films, so it's a hard decision process, but we don't really have an agenda when we're going through that process. So, but what we've seen out of this year is that we tend to have a lot of profile documentaries where filmmakers have profiled people like Richard Pryor or Elaine Stritch or Bernie Madoff's secretary or the most famous internet cat, Lil Bub from Little Bub and Friends. So there seems to be maybe a little bit of nostalgia from the filmmaking world or, you know, usually when I think every generation likes to revisit inspirations from their youth, and that just might be what we're seeing. But it's made for some really compelling documentaries about people who really were true to themselves and used their voice and affected culture and change. So we're really excited to have those docs here, and that's a bit of a thematic through the festival this year.
And talking about docs, I mean, I saw that this year you're featuring more documentaries than usual. Why is that?
I haven't actually done the numbers. I think it's the same. We do 12 in doc competition. We do 12 narrative films. And then we really have pretty much an even split through the rest of the festival. I would actually say there's probably more narratives than documentaries. But, you know, we always show documentaries. I think Tribeca has become one of the, you know, most foremost place to premiere a documentary. And we're excited about that. We've had a lot of great docs in the past, like Bully, go on to some success. And we're just trying to support all types of filmmaking. I mean, most people still haven't wrapped their heads around why they would want to see a documentary, but in fact, documentaries for many years always won our audience award competition, so it's usually generally audience favorite. So I think that's what's great about a festival, is that you can come, you can see a narrative film, you can see a horror film, you can see a drama, you can see a comedy, a romantic comedy. You can also see a wide range of documentaries in different styles, not just issue-driven documentaries or character-driven documentaries. There's personal docs and other documentaries on offer every year.
And Jenna, are there any particular countries that were very well represented in this year's festival?
Well, the United States, I think, is heavily represented because we do want to support American independent filmmaking. We have two films from France, Italy. We have two films, one from the director of Le Quattro Volte. He has a cinematic installation that we're doing for the first time with PS1 MoMA, which will run on a loop in PS1 MoMA, which is pretty fantastic. His name is Michelangelo Fermentino. And we have a good representation from the Middle East this year. We have Wajda, which is the first Saudi Arabian film directed by a woman, which is quite charming and lovely. So we have a great representation from all over the world. We have a few films from Ireland. One, it's a French co-production called Dark Touch, which is a genre movie. Another one called Run and Jump, and What Richard Did. So we try to span the globe and find films representative of the world and our global culture.
And that was Jenna Terranova there, Director of Programming at the Tribeca Film Festival, speaking with our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Now, our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, is ready and waiting to run us through the stories that have caught his eye in the British press this morning. But first, one of the stories on the websites today, Storm Thorgerson, iconic designer of so many of Pink Floyd and others' album covers. He died yesterday, sadly. And as a sort of tribute to him, let's hear Wish You Were Here Now from the Pink Floyd album of the same name, which he designed. Year after year, running over the same old ground. What have we found? The same old fear. Wish You Were Here there from Pink Floyd's album of the same name as a tribute today to the late designer Storm Thorgerson.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. And now we have the pleasure of having Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, in the newspaper chair.
Hello.
He's got the British press, the British papers with him this morning. Steve, what's caught your eye?
Well, a number of things. We're going to have a slight economic theme. And we're going to start with, there's a very good picture on the front of the Times, similar picture on the front of The Guardian, of the beautifully named Rich Ritchie, could not really make it up. The flamboyant American investment banker, as he's referred to by The Times, he was a senior official at Barclays. He'd received bonuses in previous years of up to about sort of £70 million. He'd become sort of one of the faces of unacceptable casino capitalism. And as Barclays have tried to improve its image, they have ousted him. He's been retired. The retired is in inverted commas.
And presumably he spends his time going, it's actually Ritchie.
Yes.
It's
yeah.
Ritchie. Why doesn't anyone believe me?
Yeah, it's actually Richard. Richard. You were called Rich Ritchie. And then, as I say, that the picture on the front of the Times refers to him as Fat Cat in the Hat, because he's wearing a rather fetching hat there, it must be said.
And the horse that he actually entered in Cheltenham was named Fat Cat in the Hat.
Exactly, exactly. So he looks exactly like a man who's called Rich Ritchie. He's on his way out. What that means for Barclays is, I think it's a bit too early to say, really. They're trying to change things around. They brought in a couple of new chief execs, former co-chief exec of CIB, to try and change things around, because obviously their reputation has been damaged somewhat in recent years and months.
And yeah. It is a bit early to tell, but, you know, is it expected that he's going to get a huge payout, retirement package, when he says finally goodbye?
I would not be surprised if he has a decent payout of some description. He's already had a fair bit, so I'm sure he'll be fine. Sticking with economic news, let's look at the front of the FT. They also mentioned the Rich Ritchie thing, although they have a far more sober picture of him there on the front. You know, no hat.
No horse. No tweed.
But the main story on the left-hand side, Osborne and IMF square up on austerity. Chancellor to defend Plan A aggressively. It says George Osborne is to go toe-to-toe with the International Monetary Fund next month in a battle over the credibility of his Plan A. And, you know, the IMF is coming to town next month. And the IMF is sort of, who were strong supporters of austerity, have started to sort of change their view in the last year or so, as they've realised that it's bollocks, I think is the technical economic phrase.
Thanks for that.
That it just doesn't work when you're in a recession and when everyone else is struggling as well, which a lot of Keynesian economists would have pointed out at the time. In fact, you know what? Did point out at the time.
I wonder that given the sort of the photos we've seen of George Osborne from the Thatcher funeral, there's been a lot of talk about her, the way that she was the sort of mother to this generation of Tory politicians, and that she gave them that idea of just do what you think is right, focus, don't be turned by anybody. And you wonder whether or not George Osborne is really sort of sticking to what he sees as his inherited sort of pattern from her.
I think there is something in that there is, you know, people talk about how they like conviction politicians, and they do. And, you know, and George W. Bush, when he was going for re-election in 2004, the most powerful moment of his convention speech was when he looked straight in the camera and said, look, you and I have got to know each other over the last 4 years. We can agree on one thing. Even if you don't like me, you know that when I make a decision, I stick with it. Now, some people would be a little bit worried by that because, you know, sometimes if when the facts change, then maybe you should change your mind. And I think my worry with Osborne is that he's learnt the wrong lesson from Thatcher. She may well have appeared like a conviction politician, but she was actually far more pragmatic than that. And, you know, for all the cuts that she introduced, certainly to the NHS, amongst other things, you know, public spending under Thatcher did go up slightly during those years. She was a little bit more careful. But it's interesting, this austerity stuff comes at a time when one of the, it's a story that's been rumbling on for 3 or 4 days now, one of the key planks, the key sort of academic planks behind austerity was this paper by his two Harvard academics called Rogoff and Reinhardt, who did this big piece of research which showed that if your GDP to debt ratio got above 90%, then that was essentially the moment where you fell off the cliff and growth became, in their words, at minus 0.1%. It's been very controversial, but it's been one of the things that lots of people on the right have cited. It turns out they made some mistakes, including not including one of the rows in the Excel spreadsheet. They basically didn't press return. Ouch. At certain places.
We've all done it, but I would have hoped they had someone to check their work for them.
Exactly. So it turns out actually, instead of it being minus 0.1%, it's 2.2% plus growth, which is actually not too bad. So yes, austerity has been in the news all this week, and I'm sure will be for a very long time to go.
So with all this evidence against, I guess, the case for austerity, is there any sense then from other European leaders, from the British, that they are ready to maybe change tactics a bit?
Not necessarily. But what's interesting, just to mention briefly, front of the Independent, Labour bets the House with pledge to outspend Tories. This is an exclusive by the political editor, Andy Grice. Ed Miliband, the Labour Party leader, is going to actually say, you know what, we're going to spend more than the Tories, which suggests that they are willing to say, you know, not only do we think austerity is not working, but we need a bit of a stimulus. It's going to be controversial. It's going to be difficult because it's against the main consensus here at the moment. But it certainly sets up a proper economic battle for the next election, which is in 2.5 years' time.
It certainly does. And it harks back, interestingly, to 1997 when a different version of that same argument was playing out. Steve, thanks very much as ever for joining us. That's all we have time for today's Midori House. Thank you to our producer, Aled John, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Barbara Feeney, and Sam Impey, who was our ever-able studio manager. And up after the news, it's Culture with Robert Bound. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.